child where I found her. While Three Stars was destroying American Horse's village, some of the Sioux who had escaped made their way to Sitting Bull's camp and told him about the attack. Sitting Bull and Gaul, with about 600 warriors, immediately went to help American Horse, but they arrived too late. Although Sitting Bull launched an attack on Crook's soldiers, his warriors had so little ammunition that the Bluecoats held them off with rearguard actions while the main column marched on to the Black Hills. When the soldiers were all gone, Sitting Bull and his warriors went into American Horse's devastated village, rescued the helpless survivors, and buried the dead. "What have we done that the white people want us to stop?" Sitting Bull asked. "We have been running up and down this country, but they follow us from one place to another." In an effort to get as far away from the soldiers as possible, Sitting Bull took his people north along the Yellowstone, where buffalo could be found. In the moon of falling leaves, Gaul went out with a hunting party and came upon an army wagon train traveling through the Yellowstone country. The soldiers were taking supplies to a new fort they were building, where Tongue River flowed into the Yellowstone, Fort Keogh, named for Captain Miles Keogh, who was killed at the Little Bighorn. Gaul's warriors ambushed the train near Glendive Creek and captured 60 mules. As soon as Sitting Bull heard about the wagon train and the new fort, he sent for Johnny Bruguière, a half-breed who had joined his camp. Bruguière knew how to write, and Sitting Bull told him to put down on a piece of paper some words he had to say to the commander of the soldiers. "I want to know what you are doing on this road. You scare all the buffalo away. I want to hunt in this place. I want you to turn back from here. If you don't, I will fight you again. I want you to leave what you have got here and turn back from here. I am your friend. Sitting Bull." When Lieutenant Colonel Elwell Otis, commanding the wagon train, received the message, he sent a scout with a reply to Sitting Bull. "The soldiers were going to Fort Keogh," Otis said, "and many more soldiers were coming to join them. If Sitting Bull wanted a fight, the soldiers would give him one." Sitting Bull did not want a fight. He wanted only to be left alone to hunt buffalo. He sent a warrior out with a white flag, asking for a talk with the soldier chief. By this time, Colonel Nelson Miles and more soldiers had overtaken the train. As Miles had been searching for Sitting Bull since the end of summer, he immediately agreed to a parley. They met on October 22nd between a line of soldiers and a line of warriors. Miles was escorted by an officer and five men, Sitting Bull by a sub-chief and five warriors. The day was very cold, and Miles was wearing a long coat trimmed with bear fur. From the first moment of his appearance, he was Bear Coat to the Indians. There were no preliminary speeches, no friendly smokes of the pipe. With Johnny Bruguière interpreting, Bear Coat began the parley by accusing Sitting Bull of always being against the white man and his ways. Sitting Bull admitted that he was not for the whites, but neither was he an enemy to them as long as they left him alone. Bear Coat wanted to know what Sitting Bull was doing in the Yellowstone country. The question was a foolish one, but the Hunkpapa answered it politely. He was hunting buffalo to feed and clothe his people. Bear Coat then made passing mention of a reservation for the Hunkpapas, but Sitting Bull brushed it aside. He would spend the winter in the Black Hills, he said. The parley ended with nothing resolved, but the two men agreed to meet again the next day. The second meeting quickly became a succession of disagreements. Sitting Bull began by saying that he had not fought the soldiers until they came to fight him, and promised that there would be no more fighting if the white men would take their soldiers and forts out of the Indians' country. Bear Coat replied that there could be no peace for the Sioux until they were all on reservations. At this, Sitting Bull became angry. He declared that the Great Spirit had made him an Indian, but not an agency Indian, and he did not intend to become one. He ended the conference abruptly and returned to his warriors, ordering them to scatter because he suspected that Bear Coat's soldiers would try to attack them. The soldiers did open fire, and once again the Hunkpapas had to start running up and down the country. By springtime of 1877, Sitting Bull was tired of running. He decided there was no longer room enough for white men and the Sioux to live together in the Great Father's country. He would take his people to Canada, to the land of the Grandmother, Queen Victoria. Before he started, he searched for Crazy Horse, hoping to persuade him to bring the Oglalas to the Grandmother's land. But Crazy Horse's people were running up and down the country trying to escape the soldiers, and Sitting Bull could not find them. In those same cold moons, General Crook was also looking for Crazy Horse. This time, Crook had assembled an enormous army of infantry, cavalry, and artillery. This time he took along enough rations to fill 168 wagons, and enough powder and ammunition to burden the backs of 400 pack mules. Three Star's mighty column swept through the Powder River country like a swarm of grizzly bears, mauling and crushing all Indians in its path. The soldiers were looking for Crazy Horse, but they found a Cheyenne village first, Dull Knife's village. Most of these Cheyennes had not been in the Little Bighorn battle, but had slipped away from Red Cloud Agency in search of food after the army took possession there and stopped their rations. General Crook sent Three Fingers Mackenzie against this village of 150 lodges. It was in the deer-rutting moon, and very cold, with deep snow in the shaded places and ice-crusted snow in the open places. Mackenzie brought his troopers up to attacking positions during the night and struck the Cheyennes at first daylight. The Pawnee mercenaries went in first, charging on the fast ponies Mackenzie had taken from the reservation Sioux. They caught the Cheyennes in their lodges, killing many of them as they came awake. Others ran out naked into the biting cold, the warriors trying to fight off the Pawnees and the onrushing soldiers long enough for their women and children to escape. Some of the best warriors of the northern Cheyennes sacrificed their lives in those first furious moments of fighting. One of them was Dull Knife's oldest son. Dull Knife and Little Wolf finally managed to form a rear guard along the upper ledges of a canyon, but their scanty supply of ammunition was soon exhausted. Little Wolf was shot 7 times before he and Dull Knife broke away to join their women and children in full flight toward the Bighorns. Behind them, Mackenzie was burning their lodges, and after that was done, he herded their captured ponies against the canyon wall and ordered his men to shoot them down, just as he had done to the ponies of the Comanches and Kiowas in Palo Duro Canyon. For Dull Knife's Cheyennes, their flight was a repetition of the flight of Two Moon's Cheyennes after the surprise attack in March by the Eagle Chief Reynolds. But the weather was colder. They had only a few horses and scarcely any blankets, robes, or even moccasins. Like Two Moon's people, they knew only one sanctuary, Crazy Horse's village on Box Elder Creek. During the first night of flight, 12 infants and several old people froze to death. The next night, the men killed some of the ponies, disemboweled them, and thrust small children inside to keep them from freezing. The old people put their hands and feet in beside the children. For 3 days they tramped across the frozen snow, their bare feet leaving a trail of blood, and then they reached Crazy Horse's camp. Crazy Horse shared food, blankets, and shelter with Dull Knife's people, but warned them to be ready to run. The Oglalas did not have enough ammunition left to stand and fight. Bearcoat Miles was looking for them in the north, and now Three Stars Crook was coming from the south. To survive, they would have to keep running up and down the country. In the moon of popping trees, Crazy Horse moved the camp north along the Tongue to a hiding place not far from the new Fort Keogh, where Bearcoat was wintering his soldiers. Cold and hunger became so unbearable for the children and old people that some of the chiefs told Crazy Horse it was time to go and parley with Bearcoat and find out what he wanted them to do. Their women and children were crying for food, and they needed warm shelters they would not have to run away from. Crazy Horse knew that Bearcoat wanted to make prisoners of them on a reservation, but he agreed that the chiefs should go if they wished to do so. He went with the party, about 30 chiefs and warriors, to a hill not far from the fort. 8 chiefs and warriors volunteered to ride down to the fort, one of them carrying a large white cloth on a lance. As they neared the fort, some of Bearcoat's mercenary crows came charging out. Ignoring the truce flag, the crows fired point-blank into the Sioux. Only 3 of the 8 escaped alive. Some of the Sioux watching from the hill wanted to ride out and seek revenge on the crows, but Crazy Horse insisted that they hurry back to camp. They would have to pack up and run again. Now that Bearcoat knew there were Sioux nearby, he would come searching through the snow for them. Bearcoat caught up with them on the morning of January 8, 1877, at Battle Butte, and sent his soldiers charging through foot-deep snow. Crazy Horse had but little ammunition left to defend his people, but he had some good warrior chiefs who knew enough tricks to mislead and punish the soldiers while the main body of Indians escaped through the Wolf Mountains toward the Bighorns. Working in concert, Little Big Man, Two Moon, and Hump decoyed the troops into a canyon. For 4 hours they kept the soldiers, who were encumbered with bulky winter uniforms, stumbling and falling over ice-covered cliffs. Snow began sifting down during the engagement, and by early afternoon a blizzard was raging. This was enough for Bearcoat. he took his men back to the warmth of Fort Keogh. Through the screen of sleety snow, Crazy Horse and his people made their way to the familiar country of the Little Powder. They were camped there in February, living off what game they could find, when runners brought news that Spotted Tail and a party of Brûlés were coming from the south. Some of the Indians in the camp thought that perhaps Spotted Tail at last had tired of being told what to do on his reservation and was running away from the soldiers. But Crazy Horse knew better. During the cold moons, Three Stars Crook had taken his men out of the snow into Fort Fetterman. While he was waiting for spring, he paid a visit to Spotted Tail and promised him that the reservation Sioux would not have to move to the Missouri River if the Brûlé chief would go as a peace emissary to Crazy Horse and persuade him to surrender. That was the purpose of Spotted Tail's visit to Crazy Horse's camp. Just before Spotted Tail arrived, Crazy Horse told his father that he was going away. He asked his father to shake hands with Spotted Tail and tell him the Oglalas would come in as soon as the weather made it possible for women and children to travel. Then he went off to the Bighorns alone. Crazy Horse had not made up his mind yet whether he would surrender. Perhaps he would let his people go while he stayed in the Powder River country alone, like an old buffalo bull cast out of the herd. When Spotted Tail arrived, he guessed that Crazy Horse was avoiding him. He sent messengers out to find the Oglala leader, but Crazy Horse had vanished in the deep snows. Before Spotted Tail returned to Nebraska, however, he convinced Bigfoot that he should surrender his Minneconjous, and he received promises from Touch the Clouds and three other chiefs that they would bring their people to the agency early in the spring. On April 14th, Touch the Clouds, with a large number of Minneconjous and Sanzarks from Crazy Horse's village, arrived at the Spotted Tail agency and surrendered. A few days before this happened, Three Stars Crook had sent Red Cloud out to find Crazy Horse and promise him that if he surrendered, he could have a reservation in the Powder River country. On April 27th, Red Cloud met Crazy Horse and told him of Three Stars' promise. Crazy Horse's 900 Oglalas were starving, the warriors had no ammunition, and their horses were thin and bony. The promise of a reservation in the Powder River country was all the Crazy Horse needed to bring him into Fort Robinson to surrender. The last of the Sioux war chiefs now became a reservation Indian, disarmed, dismounted, with no authority over his people, a prisoner of the army which had never defeated him in battle. Yet he was still a hero to the young men, and then adulation caused jealousies to arise among the older agency chiefs. Crazy Horse remained aloof, he and his followers living only for the day when Three Stars would make good his promise of a reservation for them in the Powder River country. Late in the summer, Crazy Horse heard that Three Stars wanted him to go to Washington for a council with the Great Father. Crazy Horse refused to go. He could see no point in talking about the promised reservation. He had seen what happened to chiefs who went to the Great Father's house in Washington. They came back fat from the white man's way of living and with all the hardness gone out of them. He could see the changes in Red Cloud and Spotted Tail, and they knew he saw, and they did not like him for it. In August, news came that the Nez Perces, who lived beyond the Shining Mountains, were at war with the Bluecoats. At the agencies, soldier chiefs began enlisting warriors to do their scouting for them against the Nez Perces. Crazy Horse told the young men not to go against those other Indians far away, but some would not listen and allowed themselves to be bought by the soldiers. On August 31st, the day these former Sioux warriors put on their Bluecoat uniforms to march away, Crazy Horse was so sick with disgust that he said he was going to take his people and go back north to the Powder River country. When Three Stars heard of this from his spies, he ordered 8 companies of pony soldiers to march to Crazy Horse's camp outside Fort Robinson and arrest him. Before the soldiers arrived, however, Crazy Horse's friends warned him they were coming. Not knowing what the soldiers' purpose was, Crazy Horse told his people to scatter, and then he set out alone to Spotted Tail Agency to seek refuge with his old friend Touch the Clouds. The soldiers found him there, placed him under arrest, and informed him they were taking him back to Fort Robinson to see Three Stars. Upon arriving at the fort, Crazy Horse was told that it was too late to talk with Three Stars that day. He was turned over to Captain James Kennington and one of the agency policemen. Crazy Horse stared hard at the agency policeman. He was Little Big Man, who not so long ago had defied the commissioners who came to steal Pahasapa. The same Little Big Man who had threatened to kill the first chief who spoke for selling the Black Hills. the brave little big man who had last fought beside Crazy Horse on the icy slopes of the Wolf Mountains against Bearcoat Miles. Now the white men had bought little big man and made him into an agency policeman. As Crazy Horse walked between them, letting the soldier chief and little big man lead him to wherever they were taking him, he must have tried to dream himself into the real world, to escape the darkness of the shadow world in which all was madness. They walked past a soldier with a bayoneted rifle on his shoulder, and then they were standing in the doorway of a building. The windows were barred with iron, and he could see men behind the bars with chains on their legs. It was a trap for an animal, and Crazy Horse lunged away like a trapped animal, with Little Big Man holding on to his arm. The scuffling went on for only a few seconds. Someone shouted a command, and then the soldier guard, Private William Gentles, thrust his bayonet deep into Crazy Horse's abdomen. Crazy Horse died that night, September 5, 1877, at the age of 35. At dawn the next day, the soldiers presented the dead chief to his father and mother. They put the body of Crazy Horse into a wooden box, fastened it to a pony-drawn travois, and carried it to Spotted Tail Agency, where they mounted it on a scaffold. All through the drying grass moon, mourners watched beside the burial place. And then, in the moon of falling leaves, came the heartbreaking news. The Reservation Sioux must leave Nebraska and go to a new reservation on the Missouri River. Through the crisp, dry autumn of 1877, long lines of exiled Indians, driven by soldiers, marched northeastward toward the barren land. Along the way, several bands slipped away from the column and turned northwestward, determined to escape to Canada and join Sitting Bull. With them went the father and mother of Crazy Horse, carrying the heart and bones of their son. At a place known only to them, they buried Crazy Horse somewhere near Changpe Opiwakpala, the creek called Wounded Knee. Chapter 13. The Flight of the Nez Perces. 1877. January 1st. Queen Victoria proclaimed Empress of India. January 25th. U.S. Congress passes Electoral Commission bill requiring recount of electoral votes. Hayes-Tilden contest still in doubt. February 12th. Railroad workers begin strikes in protest over wage cuts. February 26th, Southern Democrats meet secretly with Hayes's Republican representatives and conclude the Compromise of 1877, in which Southern Democrats agree to support Republicans in exchange for withdrawal of federal troops from the South and ending of Reconstruction. February 27th, Electoral Commission declares recount in favor of Hayes. March 2nd, Congress confirms election of Hayes. March 5th, Hayes inaugurated as president. April 10th, President Hayes begins withdrawal of federal troops from southern states, signaling end of Reconstruction era. April 15th, first business telephone installed between Boston and Somerville, Massachusetts. July 14th, general strike halts movement of railroad trains. July 20th, strike riots spread across United States. July 21st to 27th, troops battle railroad workers and force end to nationwide strike. October 17th, contract between Pennsylvania Railroad and Standard Oil Company strengthens oil transportation monopoly. December, Edison invents the phonograph. Tolstoy's Anna Karenina is published. The whites told only one side, told it to please themselves, told much that is not true. Only his own best deeds, only the worst deeds of the Indians, has the white man told. Yellow Wolf of the Nez Perces. The earth was created by the assistance of the sun, and it should be left as it was. The country was made without lines of demarcation, and it is no man's business to divide it. I see the whites all over the country gaining wealth, and see their desire to give us lands which are worthless. The earth and myself are of one mind. The measure of the land and the measure of our bodies are the same. Say to us, if you can say it, that you were sent by the creative power to talk to us. Perhaps you think the Creator sent you here to dispose of us as you see fit. If I thought you were sent by the Creator, I might be induced to think you had a right to dispose of me. Do not misunderstand me, but understand me fully with reference to my affection for the land. I never said the land was mine to do with it as I chose. The one who has the right to dispose of it is the one who has created it. I claim a right to live on my land, and accord you the privilege to live on yours. Inmatuyalaket, Chief Joseph of the Nez Perces. In September 1805, when Lewis and Clark came down off the Rockies on their westward journey, the entire exploring party was half-famished and ill with dysentery, too weak to defend themselves. They were in the country of the Nez Perces, or Nez Percés, so named by French trappers who observed some of these Indians wearing dentalium shells in their noses. Had the Nez Perces chosen to do so, they could have put an end to the Lewis and Clark expedition there on the banks of Clearwater River and seized their wealth of horses. Instead, the Nez Perces welcomed the white Americans, supplied them with food, and looked after the explorers' horses for several months while they continued by canoe to the Pacific shore. Thus began a long friendship between the Nez Perces and white Americans. For 70 years, the tribe boasted that no Nez Perce had ever killed a white man. But white men's greed for land and gold finally broke the friendship. In 1855, Governor Isaac Stevens of Washington Territory invited the Nez Perces to a peace council. He said there were a great many white people in the country, and many more would come, that he wanted the land marked out so that the Indians and white men could be separated. If they were to live in peace, it was necessary, he said, that the Indians should have a country set apart for them, and in that country they must stay. Tuekakas, a chief known as Old Joseph by the white men, told Governor Stevens that no man owned any part of the earth, and a man could not sell what he did not own. The governor could not comprehend such an attitude. He urged Old Joseph to sign the treaty and receive presents of blankets. "Take away your paper," the chief replied. "I will not touch it with my hand." Alea, who was called Lawyer by the white men, signed the treaty, and so did several other Nez Perces. But Old Joseph took his people back to their home in Wallawa Valley, a green country of winding waters, wide meadows, mountain forests, and a clear blue lake. Old Joseph's band of Nez Perces raised fine horses and cattle, lived in fine lodges, and when they needed anything from the white men, they traded their livestock. Only a few years after the first treaty signing, government men were swarming around the Nez Perces again, wanting more land. Old Joseph warned his people to take no presents from them, not even one blanket. "After a while," he said, "they will claim that you have accepted pay for your country." In 1863, a new treaty was presented to the Nez Perces. It took away the Wallawa Valley and three-fourths of the remainder of their land, leaving them only a small reservation in what is now Idaho. Old Joseph refused to attend the treaty signing, but Lawyer and several other chiefs, none of whom had ever lived in the Valley of Winding Waters, signed away their people's lands. The Thief Treaty, Old Joseph called it, and he was so offended that he tore up the Bible a white missionary had given him to convert him to Christianity. To let the white men know he still claimed the Wallawa Valley, he planted poles all around the boundaries of the land where his people lived. Not long after that, Old Joseph died, 1871, and the chieftainship of the band passed to his son, Hinmatuyalaket, young Joseph, who was then about 30 years old. When the government officials came to order the Nez Perces to leave the Wallawa Valley and to go to Lapway Reservation, young Joseph refused to listen. "Neither Lawyer nor any other chief had authority to sell this land," he said. "It has always belonged to my people. It came unclouded to them from our fathers, and we will defend this land as long as a drop of Indian blood warms the hearts of our men." He petitioned the Great Father, Ulysses Grant, to let his people stay where they had always lived, and on June 16, 1873, the President issued an executive order withdrawing Wallawa Valley from settlement by white men. In a short time, a group of commissioners arrived to begin organization of a new Indian agency in the valley. One of them mentioned the advantages of schools for Joseph's people. Joseph replied that the Nez Perces did not want the white man's schools. "Why do you not want schools?" the commissioner asked. "They will teach us to have churches," Joseph answered. "Do you not want churches?" "No, we do not want churches." "Why do you not want churches?" "They will teach us to quarrel about God," Joseph said. "We do not want to learn that. We may quarrel with men sometimes about things on this earth, but we never quarrel about God. We do not want to learn that." Meanwhile, white settlers were encroaching upon the valley, with their eyes on the Nez Perce land. Gold was found in nearby mountains. The gold seekers stole the Indians' horses, and stockmen stole their cattle, branding them so the Indians could not claim them back. White politicians journeyed to Washington, telling lies about the Nez Perces. They charged the Indians with being a threat to the peace and with stealing the settlers' livestock. This was the reverse of the truth, but as Joseph said, we had no friend who would plead our cause before the law council. 2 years after the Great Father promised Wallowa Valley to Joseph's people forever, he issued a new proclamation, reopening the valley to white settlement. The Nez Perces were given a reasonable time to move to the Lapway Reservation. Joseph had no intention of giving up the valley of his fathers, but in 1877, the government sent the one-armed soldier chief, General Howard, to clear all Nez Perces out of the Wallowa area. In the 4 years that had passed since Oliver Otis Howard treated Cochise and the Apaches with justice, he had learned that the army was not tolerant of Indian lovers. He came now to the Northwest Country, determined to restore his standing with the military by carrying out his orders swiftly and to the letter. Privately, he told trusted friends that it is a great mistake to take from Joseph and his band of Nez Perce Indians that valley. But in May 1877, he summoned Joseph to Lapway for a council which was to set the date they must surrender their land. To accompany him to Lapway, Joseph chose Whitebird, Looking Glass, his brother Olicott, and the Wallowa prophet, Tululuzote. The prophet was a tall, thick-necked, very ugly Indian with a gift for eloquent rebuttal. A fugitive from hell was the way one white man described him. At the opening of the council, which was held in a building across from the Fort Lapway guardhouse, Joseph presented Tululuzote as spokesman for the Wallowa Nez Perces. Part of the Nez Perces gave up their land, the prophet said. We never did. The earth is part of our body, and we never gave up the earth. You know very well that the government has set apart a reservation and that the Indians must go on it, Howard declared. What person pretended to divide the land and put us on it? Tululuzote demanded. I am the man. I stand here for the president. Howard was beginning to lose his temper. My orders are plain and will be executed. The prophet continued prodding the one-armed soldier chief, asking him how the land could belong to white men if it had come down to the Nez Perces from their fathers. We came from the earth, and our bodies must go back to the earth, our mother, he said. I don't want to offend your religion, Howard replied testily, but you must talk about practicable things. 20 times over I hear that the earth is your mother and about chieftainship from the earth. I want to hear it no more, but come to business at once. Who can tell me what I must do in my own country? Tululuzote retorted. The argument continued until Howard felt he must demonstrate his power. He ordered the prophet arrested and taken to the guardhouse. And then he bluntly informed Joseph that the Nez Perces had 30 days in which to move from the Wallowa Valley to the Lapway Reservation. My people have always been the friends of white men, Joseph said. Why are you in such a hurry? I cannot get ready to move in 30 days. Our stock is scattered and Snake River is very high. Let us wait until fall. Then the river will be low. If you let the time run over 1 day, Howard replied harshly, the soldiers will be there to drive you onto the reservation, and all your cattle and horses outside of the reservation at that time will fall into the hands of the white men. Joseph knew now that he had no alternative. To defend the valley with less than 100 warriors was impossible. When he and his sub-chiefs returned home, they found soldiers already there. They held a council and decided to gather their stock immediately for the move to Lapway. The white men were many, and we could not hold our own with them. We were like deer. They were like grizzly bears. We had a small country. Their country was large. We were contented to let things remain as the Great Spirit made them. They were not, and would change the rivers and mountains if they did not suit them. Even before they started the long march, some of the warriors began talking of war rather than be driven like dogs from the land where they were born. Tululuzote, released from prison, declared that blood alone would wash out the disgrace the one-armed soldier chief had put upon him. Joseph, however, continued to counsel peace. To meet General Howard's deadline, they had to leave much of their livestock in the valley, and when they came to Snake River, the stream was swirling with melted snow from the mountains. Miraculously, they got their women and children across on buffalo hide rafts without serious accident. But while they were engaged in this task, a party of white men came and stole some of their cattle from the waiting herd. Then, when they hurriedly tried to swim their livestock across the river, many animals were lost to the swift-flowing current. More embittered than ever, the chiefs demanded that Joseph halt the march in Rocky Canyon and hold a council. Tululuzote, White Bird, and Olacott spoke for war. Joseph told them it was better to live at peace than to begin a war and lie dead. The others called him a coward, but he refused to back down. While they were camped in the canyon, a small band of warriors slipped away one night, and when they returned, the Nez Perces could no longer claim that they had never killed a white man. The warriors had killed 11, in revenge for the theft of their stock and for being driven from their valley. Like many another peace-loving Indian chief, Joseph was now trapped between the pressures of the white men and the fury of his desperate people. He chose to stay with his people. "I would have given my own life," he said, "if I could have undone the killing of white men by my people. I blame my young men, and I blame the white men. I would have taken my people to the buffalo country, Montana, without fighting, if possible. We moved over to White Bird Creek, 16 miles away, and there encamped, intending to collect our stock before leaving. But the soldiers attacked us, and the first battle was fought." Although outnumbered 2-1, the Nez Perces drew Howard's soldiers into a trap at White Bird Canyon on June 17th, turning the attackers' flank, killing a third of them, and routing the remainder. 10 days later, the one-armed soldier chief brought up heavy reinforcements to do battle again, but the Nez Perces slipped away across the mountains. In a succession of shrewd military actions, Joseph outmaneuvered the pursuing soldiers, severely punished an advanced detachment, and then raced to the Clearwater, where Chief Looking Glass was waiting with more warriors. The combined force of Nez Perces now numbered 250 warriors, with 450 non-combatants, their baggage, and 2,000 horses. At White Bird Canyon they had captured several rifles and a good supply of ammunition. After withdrawing beyond the Clearwater, where their fathers had welcomed Lewis and Clark as the forerunners of white civilization, Joseph called a council of chiefs. They all knew they could never return to the Valley of Winding Waters, or go without punishment to Lapway. Only one course was left to them, flight to Canada. Sitting Bull of the Sioux had fled to the Grandmother's Land, and the American soldiers dared not go there to kill him. If the Nez Perces could reach the Lolo Trail and cross the Bitterroot Mountains, they might be able to escape to Canada. Because they were accustomed to crossing the Bitterroots to hunt in Montana, the Nez Perces quickly outdistanced Howard's baggage-laden army. On July 25th, they were filing down the canyon near the mouth of Lolo Creek when their scouts sighted soldiers ahead. The Bluecoats were constructing a log barricade at a narrow place in the pass. Under a white flag, Joseph, Looking Glass, and White Bird rode down to the barricade, dismounted calmly, and shook hands with the commanding officer, Captain Charles Rawn. The chiefs noted that there were about 200 soldiers in the camp. "We are going by you without fighting, if you will let us," Joseph said to the captain. "But we are going by you anyhow." Rawn told Joseph that they could pass only if they gave up their arms. White Bird replied that their warriors would never do that. Knowing that General Howard was approaching from the west and that another large force under Colonel John Gibbon was marching from the east, Captain Rawn decided to stall for time. He suggested that they meet again the next day to discuss arrangements for passage. To this the chiefs agreed, but after 2 more days of fruitless parleying, the Nez Perce leaders decided they could wait no longer. Early on the morning of July 28th, Looking Glass moved the warriors into a screening line among the trees on the upper slope of the canyon. At the same time, Joseph led the non-combatants and livestock up a gulch, climbed to the top of a mountain, and was well around the canyon barricade before Captain Rawn discovered what the Nez Perces were doing. The captain went in pursuit of the Indians, but after a few skirmishes with Joseph's rearguard warriors, he decided not to risk a real fight and returned to his now useless barricade. Believing that they had escaped from Howard and unaware of Gibbon's approaching army, the chiefs decided to move south to the familiar hunting country of the Big Hole. There they could rest their ponies and hunt wild game. If the white men would leave them alone, perhaps they would not have to go to the Grandmother's Land and join Sitting Bull. On the night of August 9th, the one who limps, Colonel Gibbon, brought up a mixed column of local volunteers and mounted infantrymen and concealed them on a hillside overlooking the Nez Perce camp on Big Hole River. As dawn approached, the volunteers asked Gibbon if they should take prisoners during the attack. Gibbon replied that he wanted no Indian prisoners, male or female. The night air was cold, and the men warmed themselves by drinking whiskey. At first daylight, several were drunk when Gibbon gave the command to attack. The infantry line began firing volleys, and then charged the Nez Perce teepees. 15-year-old Kautolix was asleep when he heard the rattle of rifle fire. "I jumped from my blankets and ran about 30 feet and threw myself on hands and knees and kept going. An old woman, Patsikonmi, came from the teepee and did the same thing, bent down on knees and hands. She was to my left and was shot in the breast. I heard the bullet strike. She said to me, 'You better not stay here. Be going. I'm shot.' Then she died. Of course, I ran for my life and hid in the bushes. The soldiers seemed shooting everywhere, through teepees and wherever they saw Indians. I saw little children killed and men fall before bullets coming like rain." Another teenage boy, Black Eagle, was awakened by bullets passing through his family teepee. In his fright, he ran and jumped into the river, but the water was too cold. He came out and helped save the horses by driving them up a hill and out of sight of the soldiers. The Indians, meanwhile, had recovered from the shock of the surprise attack. While Joseph directed the rescue of the non-combatants, White Bird deployed the warriors for a counterattack. "Fight! Shoot them down!" he shouted. "We can shoot as well as any of these soldiers." The marksmanship of the Nez Perces, in fact, was superior to that of Gibbon's men. "We now mixed those soldiers badly," Yellow Wolf said. "Scared, they ran back across the river. They acted as if drinking. We thought some got killed by being drunk." When the soldiers tried to set up a howitzer, the Nez Perces swarmed over the gun crew, seized the cannon, and wrecked it. A warrior fixed his rifle sights on Colonel Gibbon and made him the one who limps twice. By this time, Joseph had the camp in motion, and while a handful of warriors kept Gibbon's soldiers pinned down behind a makeshift barricade of logs and boulders, the Nez Perces resumed flight. They turned southward and away from Canada because they believed it was the only way left to shake off their pursuers. The warriors had killed 30 soldiers and wounded at least 40. But in Gibbon's merciless dawn attack, 80 Nez Perces had died, more than two-thirds of them women and children, their bodies riddled with bullets, their heads smashed in by boot heels and gun stocks. "The air was heavy with sorrow," Yellow Wolf said. "Some soldiers acted with crazy mimes." The Nez Perce rearguard probably could have starved out Gibbon's barricaded soldiers and killed them all had not General Howard come to the rescue with a fresh force of cavalrymen. Withdrawing hurriedly, the warriors overtook Joseph to warn him that the one-armed soldier chief was on their trail again. "We retreated as rapidly as we could," Joseph said. "After 6 days, General Howard came close to us, and we went out and attacked him and captured nearly all his horses and mules." Actually, the captured livestock were mostly mules, but they were pack animals which had been carrying Howard's supplies and ammunition. Leaving the soldiers floundering in their rear, the Indians crossed Targhee Pass into Yellowstone Park on August 22nd. Only 5 years earlier, the Great Council in Washington had made the Yellowstone area into the country's first national park. And in that summer of 1877, the first adventuresome American tourists were admiring its natural wonders. Among them was none other than the great warrior Sherman, who had come out west on an inspection tour to find out how fewer than 300 Nez Perce warriors, burdened with their women and children, could make fools out of the entire Army of the Northwest. When Sherman learned that the fleeing Indians were crossing Yellowstone Park almost within view of his luxurious camp, he began issuing urgent orders to fort commanders in all directions to put a network of soldiers around these impudent warriors. Nearest at hand was the 7th Cavalry, which had been brought back to strength during the year since Custer led it to disaster on the Little Bighorn. Eager to vindicate the regiment's honor by a victory over any Indians willing to fight, the 7th moved southwestward toward the Yellowstone. During the first week in September, Nez Perce scouts and 7th Cavalry scouts sighted each other's columns almost daily. By clever maneuvering, the Indians shook loose from the 7th after a skirmish at Canyon Creek and headed north for Canada. They had no way of knowing, of course, that the great warrior Sherman had ordered Bearcoat Miles in a forced march from Fort Keogh, on a course that would cut across their path. On September 23rd, after fighting rearguard actions almost daily, the Nez Perces forded the Missouri River at Cow Island Landing. During the next 3 days, scouts reported no sign of soldiers anywhere. On the 29th, hunters located a small buffalo herd. As they were short of food and ammunition, and their horses were badly worn from the fast pace, the chiefs decided to camp in the Bear Paw Mountains. Next day, after filling their empty stomachs on buffalo meat, they would try to reach the Canadian border in one more long march. "We knew General Howard was more than two suns back on our trail," Yellow Wolf said. "It was nothing hard to keep ahead of him." Next morning, however, two scouts came galloping from the south, shouting, "Soldiers! Soldiers!" While the camp was preparing to move out, another scout appeared on a distant bluff, waving a blanket signal. "Enemies, right on us! Soon the attack!" It was a cavalry charge ordered by Bearcoat Miles, whose Indian scouts a few hours earlier had picked up the trail of the Nez Perces. Riding with the charging cavalry were the 30 Sioux and Cheyenne scouts who had been bought by the Bluecoats at Fort Robinson. The young warriors who had turned their backs on their people by putting on soldier uniforms, an action which had precipitated the assassination of Crazy Horse. The thunder of 600 galloping horses made the earth tremble, but White Bird calmly posted his warriors in front of the camp. As the first wave of pony soldiers swept down upon them, the Nez Perce warriors opened with deadly accurate fire. In a matter of seconds, they killed 24 soldiers, wounded 42 others, and stopped the charge in a wild scramble of plunging horses and unsaddled troopers. "We fought at close range," Chief Joseph said, "not more than 20 steps apart, and drove the soldiers back upon their main line, leaving their dead in our hands. We secured their arms and ammunition. We lost, the first day and night, 18 men and 3 women." Among the dead were Joseph's brother Olicott and the tough old prophet Tululuzote. When darkness fell, the Nez Perces tried to slip away to the north, but Bearcoat had put a cordon of soldiers completely around their camp. The warriors spent the night digging entrenchments, expecting another attack at daylight. Instead of attacking, however, Bearcoat sent a messenger out with a white flag. The messenger brought a demand for Joseph to surrender and save the lives of his people. Joseph sent back a reply. He would think about it and let General Miles know his decision soon. Snow had begun to fall, and the warriors were hopeful that a blizzard might provide an escape screen to Canada. Later in the day, some of Miles's Sioux scouts rode out under another truce flag. Joseph walked across the battlefield to meet them. They said they believed that General Miles was sincere and really wanted peace. "I walked on to General Miles's tent." For the next 2 days, Joseph was a prisoner, held by Bearcoat in violation of the flag of truce. During this time, Miles brought up artillery and resumed the attack, but the Nez Perce warriors held their ground, and Joseph refused to surrender while he was a prisoner. On both days, a bitter cold wind flung showers of snow over the battlefield. On the third day, Joseph's warriors managed to get him free. They captured one of Miles's officers and threatened to kill him unless the general released their chief. That same day, however, General Howard and his lumbering army arrived to reinforce Miles, and Joseph knew that his dwindling band of warriors was doomed. When Miles sent truce messengers to arrange a battlefield council, Joseph went to hear the general's surrender terms. They were simple and direct. "If you will come out and give up your arms," Miles said, "I will spare your lives and send you to your reservation." Returning to his besieged camp, Joseph called his chiefs together for the last time. Looking Glass and White Bird wanted to fight on, to the death if necessary. They had struggled for 1,300 miles. They could not quit now. Joseph reluctantly agreed to postpone his decision. That afternoon, in the final skirmish of the 4-day siege, a sharpshooter's bullet struck Looking Glass in the left forehead and killed him instantly. "On the 5th day, Joseph said, "I went to General Miles and gave up my gun." He also made an eloquent surrender speech, which was recorded in the English translation by Lieutenant Charles Erskine Scott Wood. And in time it became the most quoted of all American Indian speeches. "Tell General Howard I know his heart. What he told me before I have in my heart. I am tired of fighting. Our chiefs are killed. Looking Glass is dead. Tuhuluzote is dead. The old men are all dead. It is the young men who say yes or no. He who led on the young men, Olicott, is dead. It is cold and we have no blankets. The little children are freezing to death. My people, some of them, have run away to the hills and have no blankets, no food. No one knows where they are, perhaps freezing to death. I want to have time to look for my children and see how many of them I can find. Maybe I shall find them among the dead. Hear me, my chiefs. I am tired. My heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever. Lieutenant Wood left the army not long afterward to become a lawyer and an author of satirical poems and essays. His experiences with Chief Joseph and the Nez Perces influenced his later life. He became an ardent fighter for social justice and a defender of the dispossessed. After dark, while the surrender arrangements were underway, White Bird and a band of unyielding warriors crept through ravines in small groups and started running on foot for the Canadian border. On the second day they were across, and on the third day they saw mounted Indians in the distance. One of the approaching Indians made a sign. "What Indians are you?" "Nez Perce," they replied, and asked, "Who are you?" "Sioux," was the answer. The next day Sitting Bull took the fugitive Nez Perces into his Canadian village. For Chief Joseph and the others, however, there was to be no freedom. Instead of conducting them to Lapway, as Bearcoat Miles had promised, the army shipped them like cattle to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. There, on a swampy bottomland, they were confined as prisoners of war. After almost 100 died, they were transferred to a barren plain in the Indian Territory. As it happened to the Modocs, the Nez Perces sickened and died of malaria and heartbreak. Bureaucrats and Christian gentlemen visited them frequently, uttering words of sympathy and writing endless reports to various organizations. Joseph was allowed to visit Washington, where he met all the great chiefs of government. "They all say they are my friends," he said, "and that I shall have justice, but while their mouths all talk right, I do not understand why nothing is done for my people. General Miles promised that we might return to our own country. I believed General Miles, or I never would have surrendered." He then made an impassioned appeal for justice. "I have heard talk and talk, but nothing is done. Good words do not last long unless they amount to something. Words do not pay for my dead people. They do not pay for my country, now overrun by white men. Good words will not give my people good health and stop them from dying. Good words will not get my people a home where they can live in peace and take care of themselves. I am tired of talk that comes to nothing. It makes my heart sick when I remember all the good words and broken promises. You might as well expect the rivers to run backward as that any man who was born a free man should be contented when penned up and denied liberty to go where he pleases. I have asked some of the great white chiefs where they get their authority to say to the Indian that he shall stay in one place, while he sees white men going where they please. They cannot tell me. Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade where I choose, free to choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to think and talk and act for myself, and I will obey every law or submit to the penalty." But no one listened. They sent Joseph back to Indian Territory, and there he remained until 1885. In that year, only 287 captive Nez Perces were still alive, most of them too young to remember their previous life of freedom, or too old and sick and broken in spirit to threaten the mighty power of the United States. Some of the survivors were permitted to return to their people's reservation at Lapway. Chief Joseph and about 150 others were considered too dangerous to be penned up with other Nez Perces, whom they might influence. The government shipped them to Nez Pelum on the Colville Reservation in Washington, and there they lived out their lives in exile. When Joseph died on September 21, 1904, the agency physician reported the cause of death as a broken heart. Chapter 14. Cheyenne Exodus. 1878, January 10th. Resolution introduced in U.S. Senate that women be given a hearing on suffrage. June 4th. Britain takes Cyprus from Turkey. July 12th. Yellow fever epidemic begins in New Orleans. 4,500 die. October 18th, Edison succeeds in subdividing electric current, adapting it for household use. Gas stocks fall on New York Exchange. December, in St. Petersburg, Russia, university students battle police and Cossacks. In Austria, Ferdinand Mannlicher invents magazine repeating rifle. David Hughes invents the microphone. New York Symphony Society founded. Gilbert and Sullivan present HMS Pinafore. We have been south and suffered a great deal down there. Many have died of diseases which we have no name for. Our hearts looked and longed for this country where we were born. There are only a few of us left, and we only wanted a little ground where we could live. We left our lodges standing and ran away in the night. The troops followed us. I rode out and told the troops we did not want to fight. We only wanted to go north, and if they would let us alone, we would kill no one. The only reply we got was a volley. After that, we had to fight our way, but we killed none who did not fire at us first. My brother, Dull Knife, took one half of the band and surrendered near Fort Robinson. They gave up their guns, and then the whites killed them all. Okumgache, Little Wolf of the Northern Cheyennes. All we ask is to be allowed to live and live in peace. We bowed to the will of the Great Father and went south. There we found a Cheyenne cannot live, so we came home. Better it was, we thought, to die fighting than to perish of sickness. You may kill me here, but you cannot make me go back. We will not go. The only way to get us there is to come in here with clubs and knock us on the head and drag us out and take us down there dead. Tamalapashme, Dull Knife of the Northern Cheyennes. I regard the Cheyenne tribe of Indians, after an acquaintance with quite a number of bands, as the finest body of that race which I have ever met. Three Fingers, Colonel Ranald S. McKenzie. In the Moon of Greening Grass, 1877, when Crazy Horse brought his Oglala Sioux to surrender at Fort Robinson, various bands of Cheyennes who had joined him during the winter also gave up their horses and arms, placing themselves upon the mercy of the soldiers. Among the Cheyenne chiefs were Little Wolf, Dull Knife, Standing Elk, and Wild Hog. Together their people numbered about 1,000. Two Moon and 350 Cheyennes, who had been separated from the others after the Little Bighorn fight, went down the Tongue River to Fort Keogh and surrendered to Bear Coat Miles. The Cheyennes who came to Fort Robinson expected to live on the reservation with the Sioux in accordance with the Treaty of 1868, which Little Wolf and Dull Knife had signed. Agents from the Indian Bureau informed them, however, that the treaty committed them to live either on the Sioux Reservation or on a reservation set apart for the Southern Cheyennes. The agents recommended that the Northern Cheyennes be transferred to Indian territory to live with their kinsmen, the Southern Cheyennes. "Our people did not like this talk," Wooden Leg said. "All of us wanted to stay in this country near the Black Hills, but we had one big chief, Standing Elk, who kept saying it would be better if we should go there. I think there were not as many as 10 Cheyennes in our whole tribe who agreed with him. There was a feeling that he was talking this way only to make himself a big Indian among the white people." While the government authorities were deciding what to do with the Northern Cheyennes, the Bluecoat chiefs at Fort Robinson recruited some of the warriors to serve as scouts, to help find scattered bands which were still out and were unwilling to accept the inevitability of surrender. William P. Clark, a cavalry lieutenant, persuaded Little Wolf and a few of his warriors to work with him. Clark wore a white hat while in the field, and that was the name the Cheyennes gave him, White Hat. They soon discovered that White Hat genuinely liked Indians, was interested in their way of life, their culture, language, religion, and customs. Clark later published a scholarly treatise on the Indian Sign Language. Little Wolf could have stayed on at Fort Robinson with White Hat, but when orders came from Washington for the Cheyennes to be marched overland to Indian territory, he decided to go with his people. Before leaving, the apprehensive Cheyenne chiefs asked for a final council with Three Stars Crook. The general tried to reassure them, telling them to go down and have a look at the Indian territory. If they did not like it, they could come back north. At least that was the way the interpreters translated Crook's words. The Cheyennes wanted White Hat to go south with them, but the army assigned the escort duty to Lieutenant Henry W. Lawton. "He was a good man," Wooden Leg said, "always kind to the Indians." They called Lawton the tall white man, and were pleased when he let the old and sick people ride in the soldier wagons during the day and gave them army tents to sleep in at night. The tall white man also saw that everyone received enough bread and meat and coffee and sugar. On the way south, they followed familiar hunting trails, keeping away from towns, but they could see that the plains were changing, filling up with railroads and fences and buildings everywhere. They sighted a few small herds of buffalo and antelope, and the tall white man issued rifles to 30 warriors chosen by the chiefs so they could go out and hunt. There were 972 Cheyennes who started from Fort Robinson in the moon when the ponies shed. After traveling for almost 100 sleeps, 937 of them reached Fort Reno on the Cheyenne Arapaho Reservation, August 5, 1877. A few old people had died along the way. A few young men had slipped away to turn back north. Three Fingers Mackenzie was at Fort Reno to meet them. He took away their horses and what few weapons they had, but this time he did not shoot their horses, promising that their agent would return them after they had settled down to farming on their new land. Then he transferred the Cheyennes to the care of the agent, John D. Miles. After a day or so, the southern Cheyennes invited their northern relatives to a customary tribal feast for newcomers, and it was there that Little Wolf and Dull Knife first discovered that something was wrong. The feast consisted of little more than a pot of watery soup. This was all that the southerners had to offer. There was not enough to eat in this empty land, no wild game, no clear water to drink, and the agent did not have enough rations to feed them all. To make matters worse, the summer heat was unbearable, and the air was filled with mosquitoes and flying dust. Little Wolf went to the agent and told them they had come only to take a look at the reservation. Now, because they did not like it, they were ready to go back north, as Three Stars Crook had promised they could do. The agent replied that only the Great Father in Washington could decide when or whether the northern Cheyennes could go back to the Black Hills country. He promised to get more food. A beef herd was being driven up from Texas for them. The Texas Longhorns were scrawny, and their meat was as tough as their hides, but at least the northern Cheyennes could now make soup as their relatives did. In late summer, the northerners began to fall sick with shaking chills, hot fevers, and an aching of bones. The sufferers wasted away in their misery. "Our people died, 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 kept following one another out of this world." Little Wolf and Dull Knife complained to the agent and the soldier chief at Fort Reno until the army at last sent Lieutenant Lawton, the tall white man, to make an inspection of the northern Cheyenne camp. "They are not getting supplies enough to prevent starvation," Lawton reported. "Many of their women and children are sick for want of food. A few articles I saw given them they would not use themselves, but said they would take them to their children, who were crying for food. The beef I saw given them was of very poor quality and would not have been considered merchantable for any use." The post surgeon had no quinine to alleviate the epidemic of malaria which was decimating the northerners. He frequently locked up his office because he had no medicines and went away because he did not want to be called upon by the Indians when he could do nothing for them. The tall white man called the chiefs together, not to talk to them, but to listen. "We came down on the word of General Crook," Dull Knife said. "We are still strangers in this country. We wish to get settled down where we are to live permanently, and then we will send our children to school." The other chiefs and headmen indicated their impatience with Dull Knife's words. He was not talking strong enough. They held a short consultation, and then chose Wild Hog to speak for them. "Since we have been at this agency," Wild Hog said, "we have drawn from the agent no corn, hard bread, hominy, rice, beans, or salt, yeast powder and soap only once in a while. The sugar and coffee we get only lasts about 3 days, and is issued for 7, and beef about the same. The flour has been very bad, very black, and we cannot make it rise." As for the beef cattle, Wild Hog added, "a good many were lame and looked as though they had been starved to death." Other chiefs spoke up then and told of the sickness and death among the people. The Cheyennes had agreed to use the white man's medicine, but they could find no doctor who would give them any. If the tall white man would let them go hunting, they said, they could have buffalo meat to make them well again. "Only their agent could give them permission to hunt buffalo," Lawton replied, but he promised to ask Three Fingers Mackenzie, then commanding at Fort Sill, to intercede for them. Mackenzie, who had made a career of killing Cheyennes and their horses, was able to afford compassion for the survivors now that they were defenseless. After receiving Lieutenant Lawton's reports, Three Fingers complained strongly to General Sheridan. "I am expected to see that Indians behave properly whom the government is starving. and not only that, but starving in flagrant violation of agreement. At the same time, he advised the commander at Fort Reno, Major John K. Meisner, to cooperate with the agent in obtaining rations for the Cheyennes.